one else is doing hyperspectral imagery, which would help us see these invisible problems, we will do it ourselves. Part of that, we ended up going to SpaceX and seeing the SpaceX facility that we were given by Elon Musk and the rest of the team. And that was like the Eureka moment for me that I've always loved space. And if a private company like SpaceX can do it at this scale in the US,
LA traffic inspired Hyperloop and Boring Company, Bangalore traffic should inspire even more audacious, you know.
They put a hyperspectral camera on an airplane and did the entire mapping of Afghanistan. They found $1 trillion worth of new deposits.
Wow.
Of exactly which minerals are there that they hadn't found before.
While at some level, you know, I think ISRO's achievements are obviously very commendable and very well celebrated and covered in mainstream media. But I think what is not covered that much is how much ISRO has done in building the ecosystem.
It should not be privatized because privatization is still seen as some sort of an evil for, you know, no good reason. That's a little bit of a relic from the past decades.
Aves, welcome.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to this conversation. I think space is a topic of immense interest for me. I think, as you probably know, I invested in Skyroot in 2018. We got an opportunity to interact in 2019 when you were just starting out.
Yeah.
And till this day, I regret, you know, not investing early on in Pixel, but very impressed with your story and the progress you have made. And what's even more commendable is you graduated in 2019. And you started, you know, Pixel just after graduation with the ambition of building satellites and launching in space, which is very audacious. I don't know, I'm guessing you're probably 22, 23 at that time. And that was a dream, but just in short 5 years, you have covered a long distance. You know, you're a real company now, many rounds of funding, and you've actually launched 3 functioning satellites, which are quite pioneering in the technology that you are developing, you know, 2 with SpaceX, 1 with ISRO, and you have many more launches planned in this year. So it's quite impressive. I want to start with, you know, how did this idea start, you know, when you're in college, and how does one even think about, you know, let's build a satellite manufacturing company?
So I think a few factors that probably led to Pixel while in the final year of college. One was, as most kids, I was fascinated with space, obsessed with space. I seriously looked up a plan on how to become an astronaut, but you couldn't do that through India. You had to be a US citizen to get through NASA and all of that. At different points, I wanted to be an astrophysicist, astronomer, and so on. So the love for space never really left.
This was from college or when?
Well, this was when I was a kid.
Okay.
So I grew up in Chikmagalur here in Karnataka. So I didn't get internet access until like 8th or 9th grade.
Right.
But my dad was very particular about education outside of college as well. So I used to get these encyclopedias you get about space and all of that, and there were these 2-3 books that I used to just go over, and so that love kind of remained. But the actual experiences which led me to dive deeper into space was in college. So when I joined BITS Pilani in 2015, in the first and second year, the first thing I did was join the student satellite team called Team Anant at BITS, which was a student team that was being guided by scientists at ISRO. They were coming in and teaching our students on how to design, build, and operate satellites, which is quite different from building any other hardware. So that's where I personally learned what goes into building, you know, spacecraft that need to survive in the harshness of space. And then one more, even more interesting opportunity came up in my second year and third year at college, which was the Hyperloop India experience. As part of that, we ended up going to SpaceX and seeing the SpaceX facility, a tour given by Elon Musk and the rest of the team. And that was like the Eureka moment for me that I've always loved space. And if a private company like SpaceX can do it at this scale in the US, and there were a few initial trends of that happening in India as well with Team Indus starting to do something and being in the news all the time. And we thought, you know, let's see if, you know, I can also do something in that space. The Hyperloop experience and the Team Anant experience had given that confidence that maybe if we just get started on building a satellite, maybe something will come of it. But the initial indication after looking at everything in space, from should we build rockets, to should we build space stations, to should we build in space manufacturing, the realization was, you know, some of the things seemed way out of what a college student could fund or potentially raise money for. Satellite data was, however, available for free and through college resources. And while working with different sources of satellite data, we realized that this is good, But so many other problems we still can't see with this data. Like if I have internal bleeding and I go to a hospital, they won't use a phone camera to see what's happening. I need an ultrasound or an MRI scanner. Yeah. So a different kind of hardware to help see those invisible things that are plaguing the planet. And that would be possible not by existing technology, but by building a new way of technology called hyperspectral imaging, which had been proven by NASA as a scientific concept, but hadn't been done. So to our surprise, since we couldn't find any of this, we said, you know, if no one else is doing hyperspectral imagery, which would help us see these invisible problems, we will do it ourselves.
So in 2019, there was no functional hyperspectral satellite in space.
No commercial functional hyperspectral satellite. One hyperspectral satellite by NASA had been proven and decommissioned. One hyperspectral satellite by the Italian Space Agency was there.
So you're truly breaking new ground. So technology was there. I guess NASA has probably pioneered it.
Yeah.
But it was not commercialized.
Yeah. So there are two things. One is it was not commercialized. Second, the tech that they built, the resolution that they built it for was 30 meters or so. You can see 30 meters apart. Which was good for scientific or academic purposes, but wasn't good for commercial.
Yeah.
So not only like the basic scientific concept was done, but at the same time, we had to increase the resolution and do better engineering to bring that 30 meters down to 5 meters and then from there to make it better. So I would say, yeah, thankfully, the scientific concept that hyperspectral as a concept works from space was proven. We didn't have to do that. But then now the challenge was, how do we actually do it in a cost-effective manner, do it fast, and do it at a better resolution?
Amazing. Let's talk a bit more about your Hyperloop experience. I know in 2015, 16, when the Hyperloop challenge was opened up, you know, it got a lot of coverage. And I think Elon Musk in his, you know, typical manner is, you know, obviously, you know, can dream very big and have this extremely audacious goal.
Yeah.
But how did you end up participating in that? You know, were you competing in that challenge? You know, what was the team like? And also, what are your takeaways from, you know, visit to SpaceX factory?
Yeah, yeah. I think 2016 is when he started tweeting about, I'm stuck in traffic in LA. You need a better way to figure this out. And he resurfaced the idea of the Hyperloop, which had, I think, for the first time come across in 1980s or 90s by NASA. And he said, let's do this. And then as part of that, SpaceX created a competition, the Hyperloop SpaceX pod competition. They built a 1 mile long vacuum tube at the street adjacent to their headquarters in Los Angeles. And they put out an open challenge. Okay, here's our tube. Open challenge to teams around the world. Design, build, bring a Hyperloop pod to race here. Now, I happened to stumble into the room of one of my seniors in college, 1 year senior to me, called Sibeshkar. I'd gone to actually meet his roommate for a different work. But I saw him scribbling about the Hyperloop on the whiteboard. And I'm like, oh, Hyperloop, Elon Musk. I used to sort of follow him. So we got to talking and he said, this is competition that has come out. I'm looking and sort of participating. So I said, you know what? I want to do it with you. So it was Sibesh, it was me for the first few weeks. And then gradually we brought on board a few folks from the Pilani campus and then the Goa campus and the Hyderabad campus. But the challenge was in putting together a first information pack and design to send it across. This was very different to what we had seen because even in the case of the satellite team, for example, we had at least some background to work from. But in the case of Hyperloop, that was not the case. There was, I couldn't just Google how to build a Hyperloop pod because no one had done that before. No advisor could guide us because they hadn't also done that. It was a concept long ago and it was resurfaced. Now we had to figure out firm first principles how to do it. So it was very challenging but very fun. The initial idea was for me just, maybe this gives me a small chance to meet Elon. Let's do it. Let's attempt it and see what comes of it. But we, to our surprise, got through the first stage. And then we getting through the successive stages. And finally, out of 2,500 global applicants, I think, they chose 20 finalists. And we were
the only, you guys are among the 20 finalists.
Correct. Now, those 20 finalists were given a green light by SpaceX that your designs have been vetted for risks and everything else. Go ahead and manufacture it and bring it.
And they provide funding to manufacture? No.
Zero funding. The competition had no prize, prize money, nothing. It was just about engineering. So we had to figure out our own finances and all of that. And we didn't have finances. You know, we went to bits, but, you know, sadly, I don't think there was a mechanism for us to get something from there. So all of us decided, it was a team of about 15, 20 folks at that point, let's go to Bangalore. Because we can't build it in Pilani in the middle of a desert. Bangalore has way more resources and ecosystem. We came down to Bangalore and we said, let's try to build it here. My first halves were filled with sponsorship calls, calling up people and saying, like, would you sponsor something like this? And people didn't understand what we were doing. But thankfully, Hyperloop One, which later became Origin Hyperloop, recently shuttered down due to economic situations and the fact that it takes a lot of money to build infrastructure. But they were just starting off and one of the well-funded companies in the Hyperloop space, they decided to sponsor us.
Mm-hmm.
And that got us moving. And so the second half of the day until night was about going to manufacturing facilities. Folks in Bangalore were kind enough to do it for free for us,
mm-hmm.
In return for sponsorship. So we were able to put it together in a span of 3 months in Bangalore.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, the place that gave me the confidence that you don't need a lot of experience to actually mm-hmm. build something. You don't need someone to guide you. As long as you have a dedicated set of decently smart, passionate engineers, you can sort of get it moving. Because in a span of 3 months, I would have never imagined putting mm-hmm. together like a functioning Hyperloop pod, better than most well-funded international university teams. And we had to get it done within a span of 3 months because the competition was happening in
mm-hmm.
Amazon. So we did that. We took it all the way to Los Angeles. And I mean, we faced more challenges in the supply chain also. So for example, I was working on a levitation system. At a certain speed, due to magnetic levitation, the pod starts to levitate. So there's no friction. It can move much faster. And the magnets that you had to use for that were very, very, very strong magnets. Mm-hmm. Like if your finger is in between them, it'll get crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it was also considered hazardous material mm-hmm. for shipping. If we were using an airline and they forgot the export papers in the transit lounge and mm-hmm. had to figure out how to get that out.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, out of the 20 teams, we stood 8th overall with much less funding than most mm-hmm. of the teams. Right? These were much well-funded universities like Technical University of Munich, MIT, and so on and so forth. But I think very, very formative learning experience actually taking it there, competing with sort of the best mm-hmm. in the world, getting input from SpaceX engineers who had also built their own pod there. But I think the highlight, of course, was getting to explain to Elon Musk what we had done and him asking questions around sort of what we had done and then taking us on a tour of the SpaceX factory. The biggest learning was, I think, that you just need to get started. You just need to work from first principles. And as long as you get enough input and sort of have sense checks, I think you can build any.
That's an incredible experience. Even just in your third year of a college, just to complete the Hyperloop story. So just help me visualize this pod. Like, what were the dimensions of the pod? And also, what is the critical technology pieces? And also, what the competition? What were you guys supposed to prove? Was it like certain speed you had to achieve? Just help describe, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there are two parts to the challenge. One was how fast could your pod go? Mm. That was one. Then the other one was how scalable was the pod? Mm. Because the whole point of it was to make it a viable commercial mode of transportation. Some teams decided to just make it really fast. So they built really small pods that could go really
fast. Small, like how small?
As small as in, I would say 2 feet across 1 feet.
Okay.
Right, the smallest one.
Right, okay.
That was only built for speed, but had no scalability in terms of how it would have looked like in real life. So you had to take this vehicle essentially inside this vacuum tube. So it's about, I would say the diameter was about maybe 4 feet or so.
Okay.
For the tube, it was also a small scale version. The expectation for the commercial scale version was a little big. So removing the vacuum meant that you didn't hit the air friction limit when you're traveling near the speed of sound. But obviously, you have to take care of acceleration, deceleration. Coming to the pod itself, there were different ways of looking at it. One, as I mentioned, you build it about 2 feet across 1 feet and very small, focused on speed. What we took the approach was, we said, let's build a 1:3 shrunk down model of what it we think it will look like.
Sure.
The shrunk down model was about 8 feet long. It was about 2.5 feet wide. It could accommodate one person inside. You know, scaling it three times would mean that four people could come into a pod. And the idea was you, like at a commercial scale, have multiple pods where four people could comfortably sit. So the size of a car, essentially, put inside a vacuum tube is what we sort of built that for. Different parts to it, of course. One is the aluminum structure to it that needs to be very aerodynamic because you don't, even though it's a vacuum tube, it's not completely vacuum. At really high speeds, you start to sort of see the effect.
So goal was to hit about speed of sound?
About 300 kilometers per or something around that side. So near the speed of sound. The other parts of it were the levitation thing, as I mentioned. You have to figure out how, you know, your normal tires won't work because they really start getting worn out. And so kind of like maglev, but in maglev, since you have super, you have cooled super magnets and so on, that takes a lot of maintaining to do. In our case, we said, let's do permanent magnets. So there's an aluminium track. Once the pod starts to hit a certain velocity, the speed of change of the magnetic field induces electricity in the aluminium sheet at the bottom track. That in turn creates its own magnetic field, which levitates these. So that only happens at probably 90 kilometers per hour. So you have to use a linear induction motor to accelerate it. then it levitates, and then you use the same magnetic thing to break it.
Yeah.
That was basically sort of it. Mm-hmm. And so we decided on the scalability.
Mm-hmm.
If we can build this, and if we scale it by 3 times or 4 times, mm-hmm. can this actually be something viable?
Yeah.
Our idea was not to build a commercial company. Mm-hmm. It was a student team. But yeah. the idea was that if you're building something, might as well build it for something that might be useful.
Mm-hmm. And what happened? You said you were placed 8th in the whole competition. So what are the metric you were able to achieve with your demo?
Metrics was how well designed had it been, mainly from a risk factor standpoint. Okay. We had to look at variety of risks. To if this fails,
mm-hmm.
how will you make sure that no one dies inside?
Right.
Will it break down? So I would say it was our electronics assembly was probably mm-hmm. the best okay. out of everyone that was sort of there due to the partners that mm-hmm. we worked with. But we could have done a lot better in terms of the speed that we could sort of mm-hmm. get at with the linear induction motor that we were looking at and so on. But the 8th was a combination of scalability. It was a combination of speed. It was a combination of reliability and risk factors that the SpaceX engineers...
And were you able to actually race and test it
Not in the vacuum tube. We were able to test it sort of outside there. Only the top 3 teams got to go in.
Got it. And now I know that recently the whole Hyperloop thing was shut down. What's your just sense in overall? Do you think the world will see this idea come back in next 10 years, or for now it's parked?
I mean, it's very hard to predict the future. Some countries are still continuing to sort of pour money into it. But it is not something that a private company can make happen unless mm-hmm. you had a billionaire pouring in billions of mm-hmm. dollars on their own. But even then, it is the only way it works is if there's a nationwide infrastructure in any country.
I guess billions will definitely not stop Elon Musk. You know, he's poured 40 plus billion in by Twitter. So probably some...
No, technology. But the thing is, even he wanted to do the Hyperloop, mm-hmm. the boring company,
yeah.
but he's pivoted away from that. Mm-hmm. He's probably realized that it might not make sense.
Right.
So the boring company is doing tunnels, but they have now pivoted to having Teslas go in them rather than Hyperloop pod.
Yeah.
Maybe it would work on the moon because there's no existing infrastructure mm-hmm. like railways there. Like the reason the railways worked, was because the government funded it massively.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't think any company has ever been profitable unless subsidized by the government or funded mm-hmm. by the government for railways. It has to be similar for the Hyperloop. So if UAE decides to say that we want to really do this for the sake of doing it, or Saudi Arabia does it for the line mm-hmm. at NEOM,
yeah.
maybe it'll happen. Otherwise, it's tough else.
Yeah, I guess if LA traffic inspired Hyperloop and boring engineering, Bangalore traffic should inspire even more audacious, because there's so many engineers, they spend countless hours stuck in Bangalore traffic. Yeah. So hopefully we see our own version of Hyperloop. But coming back to satellites, so 2019 when you started, how did you think about it? Did you think that within few years you will have a functioning satellite, or it was let's just start and see what happens?
I was actually very, very ambitious at that point in time. The initial timeline we had kept for ourselves was in 6 months we want to put a satellite up in space in 6 months. In hindsight, mm-hmm. obviously realized that was a little too optimistic. But we were, I was high from the Hyperloop experience. Mm-hmm. We had put this together in 3 months. And the thinking was, if we can put together a hardware system that hadn't existed before,
mm-hmm.
completely on our own, a satellite should technically be easier because there's so much literature on it, at least. There's a lot of ISRO scientists we could go to and talk to mm-hmm. give us guidance. But the realization was, given that it has to go in space where you can't really control it, it actually is way more complicated mm-hmm. than doing something on ground. So the initial thing was way more optimistic than realistic, which was in 6 months, let's try to put something up there with ISRO. But that didn't happen, obviously. So what happened was, we were still in college at that point. So the idea was, let's start it as a college student team, like we did the Hyperloop India thing. Let's go and raise sponsorship for it.
Yeah.
Put up one satellite first, then use that to start a startup or something along those lines. But very quickly, we realized that people weren't willing to give sponsorship and they didn't believe that we could launch a satellite. We went to all the phone companies and told them, give us sponsorship and give us your phone. We will put it on the satellite. And when it goes up there, we take an image of you. That's a money shot for you. You can advertise it. No one really decided to sort of take us up on that offer. And someone told us in between that probably easier if you actually raise investment so that you might have some hope of getting that investment back. So the initial set of money came from BITS alumni who we reached out to, who were, I think, more looking at it like philanthropy than investment. Okay, we'll invest sums that doesn't make a material difference to people that have made it, but gave us the initial thing to get started. So that was the first few months of just figuring out, okay, we are going to design the satellite that continued to move at its own pace.
Mm-hmm.
But getting the money to sort of build it, very quickly realized that initially the indication, can we build and launch it in less than $200,000? Mm-hmm. Realized that as you try to make it more reliable, the cost goes up a little bit more. So once we did that pre-seed round before we graduated in BITS, thanks to mainly BITS alumni, and we also got into the Techstars Accelerator that was happening in Los Angeles in partnership with NASA and US Air Force and Lockheed Martin. I think that gave a bit of validation to sort of keep moving. And the first pre-seed round that we raised was $700,000.
Got it.
Out of which $600,000 was earmarked for the satellite, $100K for everything else. So, you know, being very judicial with money, and that $600K got us the first satellite built on ground. And then, you know, we moved from there.
Amazing. And so you initially, you know, like I guess most entrepreneurs thought that you would be able to launch in 6 months. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, you know, how many years before your first satellite was in orbit?
So Feb 2019 is when we started. June 21 is when the first one went up.
So 2.5 years, not bad at all.
Not bad at all, but also there was COVID in between. That
right. Delays. So it could have been even faster.
6 to 8 months.
Yeah.
I think 6 months of that year, we couldn't even work because we were barred from traveling, obviously. Yeah. And if you can't go to the office, then you can't work on hardware.
Right.
But I think it's still fairly happy. Not happy with the fact that it was 2.5. We wanted to launch it within a year. But given the pandemic and everything else, I think not too bad.
Right. Okay, let's talk about the satellite, you know, space. I guess there's two meanings of word space here, but I mean more about, you know, what do satellites do?
Yeah.
So overall, you know, we have all these satellites orbiting around Earth in different orbits. So what are the main orbits? How far they are from Earth, right? And what is the size of the satellites? Yeah. How many satellites are up there in the sky which are orbiting? Can you just, you know, portray the picture of, you know, so that somebody listening to this podcast can visualize how many such things are, you know, orbiting around us?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I think in coming to the orbits first, right? So you have the Earth starting from, I would say, 200 kilometers or so to probably maybe 2000 kilometers or so. It's considered low Earth orbit. Usually most satellites end up in between 500 to 700 kilometers. Because that's where the lifetime of the satellites is high, and at the same time, it's close enough to not build it large.
Yeah.
So 200 kilometers is very low Earth orbit, 100 to 400 is very low Earth, and 400 to 2000 is low Earth orbit, LEO.
Okay.
Then you go from there to, you know, 20,000, 30,000 kilometers is middle Earth orbit, usually around the 10 to 20,000 kilometers range. And then you have geostationary orbits, 32,000 kilometers, that are geostationary. Yeah. The satellites in geostationary are probably, I mean, my numbers could be off by a little bit here, but, you know, not in hundreds or less than 100, because there are very few slots for geostationary satellites. Everything has to be at those Lagrange points where the gravity cancels out, and it is going with the Earth exactly at that place. So there's not a whole lot, but these are very large satellites, very expensive satellites, mostly governments, but now few communication companies. So that's on that. Then you have on the lower Earth orbit is where most of the satellites are. I think there used to be something like 3,000, 4,000 satellites before SpaceX decided to launch Starlink satellites of their own. Now, they themselves probably have launched 5,000 to 6,000 satellites into space. So we are nearing that 9,000 to 10,000 satellites in low Earth orbit. It might seem like it's very crowded because when you see these visualizations, these satellites are scaled up by a significant amount, but they're tiny. Like, you can think of it this way. On the Earth, there are more airplanes traveling at any given point in time than there are in satellites in any one given orbit or altitude. So it's easier to sort of do space traffic management in space than air traffic management. And we don't see planes crashing into each other. So it's not like it's too bad, but obviously you need to have the capability to sort of move it around. So I would say 10,000 satellites right now there that go. And there are broadly two different kinds of satellites that you build. One is for Earth imaging. Where you have cameras on them or different kinds of sensing equipment that go up there and are sensing the different parameters of the Earth. You're either looking at oceans, you're looking at farms, or you're looking at weather, you're looking at pollution. Then on the other side, you have the communication satellites. Geostationary satellites used to be where the communication was because it was easier to provide for a country. But then now you have companies like Starlink or OneWeb or Amazon Kuiper Constellation that are building low Earth orbit internet constellations with tens of thousands of satellites. So that's kind of the situation as to where we are. In terms of building a satellite itself, it is basically a computer that has ways of autonomously pointing in the direction that it wants to and taking images and beaming it up. Like, it is an automated computer in the sense. Like, for our satellite, for example, it has a camera on it, it has a radio on it, it has solar panels and batteries. Solar panels and batteries are for making sure that the power is there for the duration of the lifetime. Whenever it's in an orbit, the solar panels are pointing towards the sun, capturing power that is being used to power this autonomous set of onboard computer that's there. Then the batteries are there for storing it when it goes into eclipse where you don't have the sun. Then you have certain things like sensors. The satellite needs to know where it is. Like, there are sensors called star trackers. It looks at the star field and identifies on the basis of that which direction you're looking at. Then you have the sun sensor to identify which direction the sun is in. Then you have magnetometer, which is looking at the magnetic field of the Earth. So you know by magnetic field where it is. And then you have GPS, of course. Then you have actuators, essentially things that help control the orientation. It's called the attitude of the satellite. There are things like magnetarker, which is essentially a magnetic field generator that generates fields to interact with Earth's magnetic field to orient itself. Then you have reaction wheels, which, you know, by moving those wheels inside the satellite can move and store. So I think that is what makes the satellite move around and sort of function. But the brains of it is essentially a computer. We are coding it in there to say, do this when you see this, do this when you do that, and do this. And because we are not in touch with it 24/7. Yeah. We are only in touch with it every 90 minutes or so in our orbits. And we tell it, okay, take an image of this latitude and longitude when it comes over next. The computer then figures out everything. And once it takes the image, it figures out how to go back to looking at the sun. And then when it comes over a ground station, it orients itself automatically to look at the ground station and beam it down. So that's basically the basic sense of different parts you need to look at.
Okay, so you covered a lot of ground. Let me, you know, just recap some of it, right? So we said low Earth's orbit is about, you said between 200 to 2,000 kilometers, but mostly between 500 to 700. So that's roughly a distance between Bangalore to Hyderabad, I think it's around that, right?
Yeah.
And just to put that in perspective, right, you know, Earth's radius is 6,400 kilometers. And just 500 kilometers above that is not that far. You know, just look, zoom in from a distance, it look like just grazing the surface. Correct. Or, you know, just above the atmosphere.
Exactly.
Right? And then at the low Earth orbit, if I understand correctly, the satellite is going around at about 20,000 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, about 6-7 kilometers per second.
6-7 kilometers per second into, someone could imagine, into 3,600 for the hour. Yeah, so it comes to about 20,000, you know, because, you know, it's completing one orbit every 90 minutes.
Correct.
Which is, you know, super fast speed. And then as you go up to 32,000 kilometers geostationary orbit, that's basically speed is same as the speed of Earth's rotation. So it appears that satellite is exact same point. I think earlier satellite used to be more in geostationary, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, any communication satellite was geostationary, right, mainly. But there used to be low Earth orbit satellites for imaging mainly.
Got it. And most of the satellites in low Earth orbit now are either for communication, which telecom companies are using Starlink for high-speed internet access. I think from what I understand, a lot of companies are building that. We'll maybe come back to later. And then for imaging.
Correct.
And earlier, people were just taking the normal images, just like, you know, the picture we click from our camera.
Correct.
But you guys have been building this hyperspectral imaging. So let's, why don't you explain that in more detail? What does that even mean?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, it started in the 1990s when private companies were first allowed to build satellites in the U.S., and these were called panchromatic satellites.
Mm.
Essentially a black and white satellite,
yeah,
camera, right? You had to look at an image, it was a black and white image, and you could see certain things and count certain things and see what was happening. Then RGB cameras came into the picture, which is essentially our phone cameras. Everything human eyes see and everything our cameras capture is in red, green and blue wavelengths in the visible range. So that's three information channels that everything our eyes is converting into and everything that our cameras or pixels are there. Then in late 2000s, early 2010s, you had a proliferation of multispectral satellites, which went beyond just the visible range, R, G and B, red, green and blue. You could see things now in the infrared range. If you've seen spy movies, in the night when the spies try to see what's happening, they pick up these thermal binoculars to see the heat signatures. That is essentially an infrared range that helps you see in the dark that otherwise you normally wouldn't be able to see. Similarly, not exactly the same, multispectral satellites started with about 4 or 5 or eventually to 8 wavelengths of multispectral capture. That was the status quo until even 2018, 2019 when we started. You could see a lot of things with that, of course. You could identify crop health. You could, you know, count the number of cars in a parking lot. You could look at oil tankers and so on. But you couldn't see things like, if I wanted to look at a farm with a black and white image, of course I can barely tell if it's a farm or if it's not a farm. With an RGB image, I can tell you, okay, here's probably where crops are growing here. You know, there's buildings here. There's just normal ground. Multispectral made it a little easier to identify. This is definitely a crop and it's healthy or not healthy. But which crop is it? What are the nutrient contents in the soil? I couldn't say that. Or with multispectral, I can look at an oil and gas pipeline and say there's a pipeline here. But what about the invisible gas leaks from there? With the, that's methane or something else. Or what about an underground oil leak where you can't even see the pipeline, but we know it is there. All that you couldn't see. That's where going way beyond these eight wavelengths come into the picture. There are three resolutions we talk about in space. Spatial resolution, which is how clearly can you see something. 30 centimeters means I can see 30 centimeters apart. 1 meter means I can see 1 meter apart. That had been taken care of because with black and white and RGB camera. Second was temporal resolution. How frequently can you come back to a place? Planet Labs in 2010s, you know, revolutionized that by putting 150, 200 satellites that could do daily revisit anywhere on the globe, right? So you brought down the temporal resolution from weeks to every day. What was lacking was the spectral resolution. How much spectra or wavelengths or information channels can you capture? That's where hyperspectral came into the picture. And for us to see those pest infestations, crop diseases, nutrient contents, for us to see those oil and gas leaks, for us to identify which minerals are where. Is that lithium or is that marble or is that just a normal stone? Or, you know, what is it actually there? Or identifying chemical contaminants in our rivers or water, in our soil, in our air. All those needed that spectral resolution. And to our surprise, when we said, okay, NASA has hyperspectral data that has come down, there are a few research papers that are comparing hyperspectral with multispectral and showing hyperspectral can help us see 50 times more information than multispectral. Great, we should use this for most things then. And we tried to find if someone could sell us that data. To our surprise, we found not a single company that was providing this, not a single way of obtaining hyperspectral data from space. So we reached out to about 40-odd customers initially who were working with satellite data to ask them, this is actually going to be useful to you? Is this just like a nice to have or a must have? We got really strong feedback that, look, if you are able to get this done, we have experimented with it on drones and so on, but at scale, we need it from satellites. No one has been able to provide it. If you provide it at such and such resolution, like as I said, NASA had done it at a 30-meter resolution. That wasn't good enough for them. If they said if you can do it at 10 meters, bare minimum, or 5 meters ideally, then we will obviously pay for it and replace what we are doing. So we knew that, okay, at least there's some sense of market here. And this technology is new. And we had challenges because we couldn't just replicate what NASA had done. It was a 300 kg satellite, some 1,000 kg satellites, costing $50+ million. That makes no economic sense. So not only did we have to figure out the fact that 30 meters, how do we make it 5? But at the same time, we had to bring it down to single-digit $1 million per satellite. We had to figure out how to make it quick and so on. Thankfully, the technological trend of miniaturization of electronics and low launch cost and all of that was in our favor, which helped, right? So we banged on that wave. But at the same time, obviously, we had to figure out from first principles how to design and build this. So that's what hyperspectral data is. It helps us see way beyond just the three wavelengths human eyes can see, or even eight wavelengths that today's multispectral satellites can see, to just show us way more than.
So you do a lot more than those eight wavelengths. And just to understand, 300, and just to be, you know, maybe somewhat technical details. So visible, you know, light is, I don't know, something between 4,000 to 7,500, you know.
400 to 700 nanometers.
Nanometers, right? So you go lower, like higher wavelength.
No,
from that?
The lower we keep as 400.
Okay.
400 to 2,500.
Got it. Understood.
So 400 to 700 is just visible.
Mm-hmm.
And then from 700 to about 1,000, 1,100 is near infrared.
Right.
And then after that is shortwave infrared.
Got it. And what changes as you go into, so I guess you are going into, let me see it right. You are going to, as you go 400 to 1,000 or 2,000 nanometer wavelength. So wavelength is increasing. And what is the additional information you are able to get at those wavelengths which you can't get?
So it's like, think of it like this. Everything in the world, everything in the universe emits a spectra.
Yeah.
Like we emit spectras, this water emits spectra. So when, for example, how did we figure out that sun was made out of hydrogen and helium? It was by having a spectrograph that people looked at the sun and they said, okay, this is the spectral signature. Compare it with which of these atoms does that. So they were able to find out it's hydrogen, helium. So like that, if I'm looking at a particular crop, let's say rice has a distinct spectral signature, right? So if I am only limiting myself to these tens of wavelengths or hundreds of wavelengths in the 400 to 900 nanometer range, I can see things in the vegetation range because they reflect light in that spectra. But if I want to see methane, its reflectance only sort of becomes visible between 1600 to 1700 nanometers. So for me to see methane, I need wavelengths in that range. For me to see some other minerals, I need to be at 2100 nanometers, probably bauxite and aluminium at that wavelength. Up to 2500 will, make me give data like, is this cobalt, is this lithium, is this uranium? So the reason why we cover that entire range and with 300 wavelengths, which are continuous in that range, is different parts of the spectra are peak reflectance spectra for certain chemicals. And if we cover that entire range, we can see most things.
Super clear. And what are, I mean, you alluded to some of the applications, but let's talk more about it. Which are the industries which majorly need this hyperspectral satellite? I mean, you're doing incredibly exciting, technology work. It's a genuinely deep tech startup, but you're also building a business.
Correct.
At some point, you want to have hundreds, probably thousands of, these satellite up in the orbit, for which you also need customers.
Correct.
So who are possible customers, and how can they benefit, and how do you estimate, potential size of that market?
So I think there are four major industries that we focus on today, but the use cases are many. The reason why hyperspectral has so many use cases is because it's a superset of all of the data. We can do the same things being done, but we can do so much more. But let's look at the industries, right? So agriculture is a big one. I think that's where mostly the largest number of our signed customers come from. These would be seed companies. Let's say we worked with a seed company whose job is to do different kinds of seeds and provide it to farmers. And we monitor the growth patterns of those seeds where they're grown. And these are grown in multiple geographies, US, Brazil, Europe, Asia. And you can't just send a drone once and only get it, as you need to cover that. Only satellites can do that. So we work with these seed companies. We work with fertilizer companies. So fertilizer companies, one of the companies that we are working with in Middle Europe, is they want to look at the soil nutrient content. So if we look at a farm, we can create a soil nutrient map from hyperspectral data. So we can tell if nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, what is missing from where. The fertilizer companies goes with that information to the farmer and tell them, hey, look, in your part of the field here, nitrogen is missing.
And this you can do at what resolution? Can you,
at 5 meter resolution.
So every 5 meter, you can tell the difference if the nitrogen content is varying.
Correct.
That's incredible.
Exactly. Actually, in less than 5 meters, because hyperspectral allows you to do sub-pixel classification. But just for the ease, 5 meter across 5 meter blocks, we are able to tell what's changing in 5 meter durations. So that's one example. On the agri side, multiple kinds of industries here. For example, even commodity traders want to know what will be the yield for a crop somewhere so that they can plan. Governments want to know what will be the yield so that they can plan exports, imports. Then you go to oil and gas companies. There are three use cases. One is exploration. We can help oil and gas companies say, look, don't pollute and go and ravage all of these areas. We are telling you hydrocarbons are here. So just go to that area because oil drilling is not going to stop at least a few more decades. So what the best we can do is say, okay, instead of going out and searching and drilling in places you might not find it, here is where.
So the places that might have oil, the spectral signature changes.
Correct. So hydrocarbon usually have hydrocarbon seepages. If it's onshore, these hydrocarbon seepages are with soil, so we pick up that spectral signature of the hydrocarbon. Or in water, usually you find thin slicks of these hydrocarbons. So you can tell, oh, here's where we are seeing the signature. Go and look at this area. So exploration is one. Second is their existing assets, oil and gas pipelines, and other things. Whenever there is a leak from there, we can detect methane. We can detect any other thing. Especially if it's an underground pipeline, there's no way to know if it's leaked until it becomes too big. What happens when leaks, however, is soil characteristics change. So that spectral signature doesn't change. So we know what a normal soil signature looks like. And when that changes, we know, okay, there's probably a leak. Go check. And the third is environmental impact. Now, there are big regulatory concerns across the globe. Governments are cracking down that you do your work, but tell us what impact you're creating on the environment and what you're doing to help solve for that. Similar use cases in mining. Exploration, telling exactly which minerals are where, identifying existing mines to see risks, and third, environmental impact. So mining is actually going to be a big one because everyone's trying to find where these rare earth minerals now are for the EV revolution and batteries and everything. One of the interesting anecdotes that gave us the confidence that hyperspectral is what is needed was actually USGS, the United States Geological Survey. They were in Afghanistan when US was occupying Afghanistan. They did hyperspectral flights through an airplane across many, many months because it was an airplane. It takes many time. With satellite, you could do it in a week. But for many, many runs, they put a hyperspectral camera on an airplane and did the entire mapping of Afghanistan. After that, they found $1 trillion worth of new deposits.
Wow.
Of exactly which minerals are there that they hadn't found before. New. $1 trillion worth of new mineral deposits.
In Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan.
Phew.
Just because hyperspectral maps are able to create.
Yeah.
Just go and Google USGS Afghanistan hyperspectral map. You will see these very colorful maps that are telling you exactly where it is. Now imagine doing that at global scale. We can tell India, you know, we found it in J&K.
Yeah.
But we found it here, 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 and there. So, you know, we can get that self-reliance and so on. So that's mining. And finally, environment and climate. I think that is our most, you know, that's something that's close to heart. Our vision statement is building a health monitor for the planet. See the health parameters of the planet, how they are changing and what we can do to make it better.
So can you like tell the air quality from the hyperspectral images?
Exactly, yeah. So we can look at Delhi, for example.
Yeah.
And we can identify in the atmosphere, these are the greenhouse gases. And these are coming from here. You know, this part of the city is leaking this and they were not supposed to do that. Or this part of the industrial base is leaking waste into water.
Yeah.
So that's something we can do with hyperspectral. Right now, Sentinel, which is the European Space Agency satellite, does it at, I think, kilometers resolution. We can get it down to 5 meter resolution, which means you can identify exactly where something is coming up.
Incredible. Let's talk about the process of building satellite. I know you guys have a large manufacturing facility right here near Bangalore. So, yeah, what goes into, you know, someone has to visualize, you know, what does a satellite look like? And we'll probably put some images, you know, so people can see it also when they're watching this. But just from soup to nuts, you know, just starting, you know, how do you start? Where do you source the parts from? How do you assemble together? What goes into? How complicated is it to build a satellite?
Yeah, I think the design stage for the satellite you're building for the first time itself takes 8 months at least, right? Because you have to start with mission requirements first. You need to say the mission needs to do this, this, this. On the basis of that, you design the orbit, you design the mission. On the basis of that, you start to narrow down your system requirement. This is what the satellite needs to be to adhere to the mission requirements. Like an example, mission requirements state that the resolution of the mission needs to be at 5 meters. That then says that the camera has to be of a certain size because of, you know, physics. That's what physics allows. The camera size then tells you the satellite size, right? So that's sort of the flow. Once the design is done, now you have to look at a supply chain which is global for us. We can't get supply chain from certain countries because of security reasons given the sector we are in. But about 55% of our components are sort of procured from India and 45% come from 26 countries. I think 26 is the number from Europe, North America predominantly. Certain things like really high efficiency solar panels. You know, we need to generate power. It needs to survive. So very high efficiency solar panels and specific space grade batteries that we need to sort of put together their battery packs that we procure from Europe. The main focus for the big chunk of the design stage and initial manufacturing is the camera. Because that is what makes the satellite useful.
How big are these cameras? I would just visualize like 1 foot wide or...
It depends on what kind of satellites you're building. In our case, you know, the camera is about 350-400 millimeters.
Got it.
Right, 30-40 centimeters.
Right.
The larger satellites we are planning on launching next year, these will be as big as 1 meter.
And that is the size of the lens?
That is the, so 1 meter cross... 1 meter cross half a meter will end up being the rough volumetric dimensions of the optics, the sensor, and everything else. So the larger the camera, the better the resolution.
Do you manufacture these cameras?
We do. So we design them in-house, completely in-house. But we need to take that design then to specialized manufacturers of these components.
So while, you know, people see of you as a satellite company, you are probably also building one of the most advanced cameras in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's probably another business line for future.
So the cameras is what makes the satellite the satellite. It's a big part of the satellite.
Yeah.
The satellite parts of it is not fully commoditized, but it's on the way there. There are 15, 20 companies in the globe that can build satellites.
Yeah.
We try to be at the cutting edge, but there are probably 3, 4, 5 other companies that can also build at the same cutting edge. But it's the camera that we're building that really separates us from the rest of the side. So the camera is what we need to make sure that the camera is stable. The camera can perform and doesn't shrink and expand in temperature. Because in vacuum, as you go from the sunlit period to the eclipse period, the temperatures vary significantly.
How much?
It can go all the way up to 40, 50 degrees sometimes, mm-hmm. to as low as minus 15, minus 20.
Mm-hmm.
That's the range that we need to design the satellite for. That's what we test on ground also. So once the camera, we know here's how it looks like, then the satellite is built around it. The computer obviously needs to make sure the satellite survives, but it also needs to make sure that the camera, when it is pointing to a certain direction, is going to actually look there with certain mm-hmm. accuracy, that it's going to be stable. You can't have it shaking mm-hmm. in space, and it needs to just be looking at that place as it capturing the image. And then you have the radios that, mm-hmm. you know, the data is captured by the satellite, stored in the satellite. Then at the end of the orbit, it comes over a ground station.
Mm-hmm.
And then the radios point towards the ground station, and you have a period of 8 or 10 minutes mm-hmm. in the field of view to downlink all of that. Mm-hmm. You repeat it every orbit. So it takes about, I would say, getting the components into our factory mm-hmm. is the longest waiting mm-hmm. period.
Yeah.
Some are very, you know, rare kind of components that we need to get. They take up to 18 months to come. So we need to place an order 18 months before mm-hmm. we can actually start using it. And we try to speed that up by having backups and, you know, paying more and so on. Once all of the components come to our facility, mm-hmm. then it's a matter of 3 months to mm-hmm. put it all together, test it, take the satellite to, we call it a thermo vacuum chamber.
Mm-hmm.
We put it in, it becomes a vacuum. It sees plus 15, yeah. minus 40 degree temperature mm-hmm. to make sure it's working, and it will work there. You take it out, you put it on the vibration table
yeah.
to make sure that the launch loads you will see on the mm-hmm. rocket can survive.
Yeah.
And then you know, test, do the final test, and then ready to ship to launch. But yeah.
And broad range of cost, let's say, so, you know, yeah, how much does it cost for someone to place an order with you and get a satellite in orbit?
The costs for satellites could range from as low as $500,000 to as high as $500 million. Mm-hmm. So, again, depends. But in our case, for the images that the CAM satellites that we build, again, if you're building like a small CubeSat, most yeah. student universities can now build CubeSats, mm-hmm. that'll be sub-$1 million, usually sub $500,000-ish or so, for building about a CubeSat that's the size of 30x10x10, a shoebox size satellite. For the satellites that we are building, without getting into exact costs, there are two classes of satellites. We build 50-kilogram satellites compared to like the 5-kilogram CubeSats. It's 50, size of a mini refrigerator. But really packed and dense. And then we are going to be building 200 kg satellites, which will be the size of, half a large fridge, right? 1 meter cube. The cost, again, there could range from low single-digit millions of dollars to as high as $10 million, depending on the complexity and the exoticness involved. But that's also because I think we're a startup and based in India. If you were building something like this in US and Europe, you can easily 3x to 5x the cost.
So you have that 3x to 5x cost advantage in India?
At least 5x, I would say. Up to 10x in some cases, we have seen.
That's incredible. Where is this cost advantage coming from? Because component, I'm assuming, are not going to cost. So it's mostly like the manpower cost is a big difference?
It's a combination of a few things. Yeah. Okay, one is the technical approach itself that we have taken, where we have figured out a way where the cameras can be smaller, and at the same time, higher resolution. Usually, those are on two opposite ends of the spectrum. So, I think that's the technical moat. Make it smaller without, you know, as much as physics allows you. And at the same time, make it higher quality. Smaller satellite and camera means lower costs. And smaller satellite also means lower launch costs, because launch cost is some $1,000 per kilogram. So the lower the kilograms, the lower your launch cost. So overall, it reduces it. What has also happened in India, thankfully, is over the last 4 decades, ISRO has built up this tremendous ecosystem of supply chain providers in the country. And India's space program has always been known for its judiciousness in terms of how cheaply they have put stuff on Moon and Mars. And that is something we are leveraging. So when we go to the same vendors that provide to ISRO, now we become their second customer for those space-specific things. And those costs are lower than if you were to procure it from, let's say, North America or Europe. So 55% of the cost I mentioned is within India. That keeps it lower. The testing costs are also lower in terms of infrastructure. We just go into ISRO, we test it, we bring it out. The additional bonus part is, of course, the labor. Much cheaper compared to, again, North America or Europe, but two levels to it. There's the hardware itself that's cheaper due to the fact that we are leveraging this ecosystem in India. And the second is the labor cost.
Look, this 5x cost advantage is incredible, right? It means, you know, at a certain scale, you should be able to corner a lot of demand from all part of the world. I mean, who will want to pay, you know, 5 times more if you can get something done, you know, at that 20% of the cost other parts of the world.
Yeah.
I think this, you know, while at some level, you know, I think, you know, ISRO's achievements are obviously very commendable and very well celebrated and covered in mainstream media. But I think what is not covered that much is how much ISRO has done in building the ecosystem
Correct.
That you're talking about. You know, same thing with Skyroot also. They are able to leverage so many partners and vendors and facilities within ISRO itself to really give a boost. Because, you know, I mean, look, rocket science is not easy, you know, to be able to build rockets or build satellites and, you know, go from a startup to launch in few years. It's only possible because of the, you know, the infrastructure that ISRO has already built. So are you able to, like, you know, as you went about building, you know, Pixel, what has been your experience with ISRO? And I guess in space might be working with you now. Yeah. Just talk a bit more about, you know, support from the these agencies.
Yeah, I think it has been a roller coaster, right? But always been positive, right? So I think first and foremost, we, ever since our earliest days, worked with a lot of retired scientists from ISRO who were our guiding beacons to saying this works, this doesn't work. We took that as a thing that, okay, this didn't work there, but, you know, but at the same time, we can't just take that and we have to also test and push the boundaries on our end. But that support has always been there from retired ISRO folks. I remember in 2019, from college, in the new academic building, I just looked up a number on the internet around ISRO and called them up and like, hey, we are a student team looking at doing a company, trying to build and launch satellites. What is the cost of launching a satellite? And he really wanted to help the person on the other side, but he's like, oh, but we don't have a process for launching an Indian private satellite. How will you get the regulations and other things? But if you come as a foreign company, then we have a way, because that's what they've been doing. So it was surprising. They wanted to help, but there was no mechanism for them to sort of help. There was no guidelines that they should help. And some people wanted to maintain the status quo, and space is very important to the country. It should not be privatized, because privatization is still seen as some sort of an evil for you know, no good reason. That's a little bit of a relic from the past decades. But in 2020, in between COVID, when we couldn't do any work on the satellites, the finance minister announced, amidst a slew of other economic measures, privatization of space. Now things started to come up, and it actually came from the prime minister's office. So the story goes, Dr. Sivan, who was the previous chairman, he inaugurated our office, the old office, and he was mentioning the story to me that he was presenting the list of satellites that have gone up to space, and in a slide there was private satellites from India, zero. And the prime minister was like, why is that the case? Let's change that. And then in 2020, they announced, let's privatize space. No point in only ISRO doing, and ISRO needs to work in tandem with the agencies so they can focus on the cutting edge R&D stuff, sending humans to space, sending humans to moon, space stations, while the other satellites and rockets can be handed over to the private industry.
Yeah.
Things that have already been done and researched. So that was when things changed. We had initially planned to launch the satellite from abroad, but we got a call then from the Department of Space saying, now that this has privatized, we wanted to launch from India. We're like, we're very happy to do it. Why do we need to worry about logistics to a different country, export and so on? We can just do it with PSLV. And so we then shifted our launch to the ISRO PSLV after, you know, talking to them and moving it from, you know, what we were planning to launch from abroad on. And then last year, space policy came out, but we knew that the space policy was coming out the 2-3 years before that. They actually were very receptive to feedback from startups like us, which is generally, I don't think, ever been the case for anything. Usually big companies tend to come in and dominate that. But in our case, I could give you very specific examples in the policy, 4 or 5 places where we had talked to the Prime Minister's office, we had talked to the Department of Space, and we said, this probably doesn't make sense because India will be at a disadvantage compared to other countries. And they actually cut down a lot of things to make it very liberal. So now things are very different. So we've seen that phase where there was no way for the government to sort of help, to there actually being a push from all the way from the Prime Minister's level. And we became the first company ever in 2021 early to actually test our satellite at ISRO facility, where they opened up the facility, we took our satellite and we tested it, we brought it out, and then we launched it with ISRO PSLV. So from there, now then they created InSpace. They were like, okay, under Department of Space, there is ISRO. So let's not create a conflict that you have an operator in the space and the same is the regulator. Let's create a different regulatory body called InSpace, who has now become the nodal body for everything. So if you want to register our satellites, we go to them. If you want a frequency license, we go to them. If you want a launch authorization, we go to them. They coordinate between Department of Space, Department of Defense, and other ministries. So thankfully, now it's become easier for any new startup to come in and leverage these facilities rather than, you know, when we were there, we were probably the only company close to launching something, and so we could do that. Now, thankfully, due to all of this, investors are a lot more relaxed about putting money into the sector. companies, more and more companies are coming up, which means more companies will see success also. So I think overall very good.
See, you know, both sides of this story are so encouraging. On one hand, you know, company like yourself, Skyroot, Agnikul, they all started when the privatization of space wasn't even, you know, legal in the country. But you guys had the, you know, the courage and conviction that let's start building something and something will open up. And on part of government also, they acknowledge and been extremely proactive, you know, in the such a very fast pace, you know, privatization, then the space policy, then creation of InSpace. This is, you know, they are moving also as fast as startup speed. And as a result, now I think the whole space sector is starting to see, you know, a lot of both startups coming up as well as a lot of investor coming in. Yeah, so you guys have raised, you know, substantial capital from, you know, well-known investors who can think about this in the long term, which is all, you know, great for the sector. And I think, you know, the you know, both receptivity from ISRO as well as the government needs to be definitely acknowledged. And I think it bodes well for future. Speaking of future, so now I think in some ways you've crossed the product market fit stage. You already have a functioning satellites in orbit. You have paying customers. How do you ramp up? Let's say things go really well. What is your ambition or vision over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, the vision is, I think, a 50-year vision, actually. Yeah. I remember the pre-seed deck that I had created still. And one of the slides was Pixel's plan all the way to 2070, which I think played a small part in the initial investments that came in. Over the next 5 years, it's to become the health monitor for the planet. Launch at least 24 satellites. We don't need hundreds of satellites. So the way that we've designed our satellites and our system is, why do we need to launch 400, 500 satellites like other companies want to do and spend so much money when you can spend a little bit more on each satellite and play with orbital dynamics to make sure just with 24, I can cover every part of the globe every day. That's our goal. So launch 24 satellites across the next 2 years, six of the 24 launching this year, which will already give us global revisit every day. It means I'm looking at Bangalore, I can come back and look at it in 24
hours. And when you say global revisit, every square inch of Earth?
Major part of the land mass, I would say. They won't be doing the oceans, right? So with six satellites, I can revisit any place every day. If I can do Bangalore, I can do New Delhi, I can do Tokyo, I can do New York. But if there are conflicts in the same region, I'll have to prioritize one over the other for a daily basis. But with 24, then I can do almost every part of the land mass every day with the capacity that will be there, which takes other companies about 150, 200, in some cases 450 satellites to provide the same level of daily landmass coverage, at least globally. That's the goal for the next 3 years, launch these 24 satellites. Then through our platform, build models that can actually help extract insights from this data for customers. Bringing down data is less than half the problem solved. Fine, you have a unique data set, you're bringing it down. But except maybe 20, 25 companies in the globe, other companies don't have the internal expertise to then work with this complicated data set to get insights. So they can just log into our platform, like Google Earth. They can put in the name of the place. They can put in coordinates. It'll take them there. They can draw whatever shape they want. And they can say, give me a nutrient map of this place by selecting nutrient map model on our platform. It generates it for them. They don't have to worry about how to build this model and who's building it and who's validating it on ground, who's doing the ML training and so on. So the next part after launching these 24 satellites and in parallel also a little bit is build these models for agriculture, oil and gas, mining, environment, so customers can actually go there and start to see which parts we can dive deeper into. We're seeing a lot of interest in the carbon credit space. People want to buy and sell carbon credits, but who is actually validating if a particular part of the forest has this much amount of carbon sequestered and so on? So we need some validation. That's where our data comes in. And hopefully also in the fourth, fifth year from now, we want to start looking at deep space spacecrafts through a combination of either from our own revenues, sending scouting missions to the asteroid belt or near-Earth objects to look at which asteroids might be mineable in the future, or working with ISRO, NASA, JAXA to figure out if we can send it to the Moon, Mars and other planetary bodies, working together with them where, you know, the revenue comes by them paying similar to how NASA pays the lunar landers right now. And at some point, using all of that map of the solar system to maybe even eventually extract resources in space for space and build an in-space economy. That is the 20-30 year vision. But the next 5-10 years, just dive deeper into more and more cutting edge satellites, expand the vision of what we can see with the planet and build models to analyze.
Amazing. So I mean, this I think the vision of the next 5 to 10 years in being a health monitor for planet, and I think it can't be any more timely because the health of the planet, unfortunately, is continuing to deteriorate.
Yeah.
And despite, you know, there's a lot of effort being put in, but I think we're still putting more carbon each year compared to the previous year, we're yet to hit peak carbon, which I think now it's estimated 2029, which is 6 years out.
Yeah.
And even when we hit peak carbon, doesn't mean that overall carbon start declining. We're still adding more. It just will add a little less than the previous year, but the aggregate. So I think the world desperately needs this health monitor. I hope, you know, you get to your 24 satellite goal soon and able to build these services. But I'm also very curious about, you know, this is outstanding that you had in a pre-seed round a 50-year vision. So what was your 50-year vision? What is the articulation?
Yeah, I think 50-year vision was essentially being able to extract resources from asteroids in space to build infrastructure in space. I don't think it's a question of if humanity will start living in space rather than just visiting it in space. It's a question of when it will happen. Moon and Mars are essentially stepping stones for humanity's interplanetary future or interstellar future, right? If we want to actually explore the galaxy beyond just robotic spacecrafts and probes, we will need to create biomes of our own. Large structures in space that can be generation ships where multiple generations can live and go beyond. Again, this is very far out in the future, but you need to start somewhere. So as we start setting bases on the moon, which the US, China, India are planning to do in the next 2-3 decades, we will do that on Mars, which Elon Musk and SpaceX sort of want to do. At some point, we will need material to be built larger space stations in space. Mining more on Earth and sending this up to space is not something that will make sense. Why do you want to damage the planet more for that when there is a significantly larger volume of these materials available in the asteroid? We just have to figure a way to refine that. It will probably start with extracting water from these asteroids to use as fuel, splitting into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can use for thrusting and maintaining fuel in space. It will then probably move on to using materials to build large-scale antennas or large-scale solar panels and optics. And eventually, it will move on to getting any mineral that we want to build these space stations and sort of maintain that. That is the 50-year vision. In between, of course, we will expand into satellite manufacturing as a service, which we've recently done. We will expand into weather satellites. We will expand into providing different kinds of these constellations, working with space agencies to develop our expertise of sending deep space spacecraft. All of that in between over the next 10, 20, 30 years will lead to a point where hopefully we will have enough cash flow and revenue to then do it ourselves and help catalyze that. So,
amazing. So when you said deep space spacecraft, and so that means things beyond, you know, sending things to orbit. Correct. So you don't want to get into rocket business.
We don't.
That, you know, so many other companies are doing. But, you know, you have to send something, you know, on those rockets to do something.
Exactly.
And that's where you want to specialize, you know. Today it's like hyperspectral satellites.
Yeah.
But there are many other kinds of, you know, rovers in future or satellites around moon, satellites around
the spacecraft that will orbit the moon. And
yeah.
Tell us what minerals and where is the
minerals
on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
What is actually on Mars?
Yeah.
What is actually maybe in Jupiter or Titan or Enceladus?
Okay, so mostly in the more satellites, not like landing equipment. And
maybe we will get into that.
Okay.
Too early to say, but I mean, our expertise is building spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
We can use that expertise to build deep space spacecraft that orbit also. In fact, then the reason why I narrowed down on hyperspectral pixel was I was reading about asteroid scouting and mining. And how do you identify what is actually in an asteroid? You use hyperspectral sensors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you know, great. So, like, the step one is, why don't we build hyperspectral sensors for the Earth? That's needed. Step two, use the same hyperspectral sensors to then look at asteroids. Step three is, once you know what is where, then you can go and extract it. So, spacecraft is our expertise today. But we might be able to get into other things depending on the opportunity.
Fair.
Definitely not rockets. There are skylights of the world and others building it. So we will just depend on that infrastructure.
Excellent. What about, I mean, where are we, you know, space mining? So, and maybe let me frame the question differently. See, today, the primary use of satellites is in either communication or imaging. And I think that will continue to increase. I think there are a lot of things that can happen through that. But space in some ways also somewhat suffering from the fact that it's not a big industry. Are there not too many commercial use cases? When people talk about space tourism, maybe we can touch upon that later, but again, I don't know how big will that be. Space mining is potentially very big, but where, let me zoom out, where are we in the world? Is there a realistic scenario of even getting something from some asteroid back to Earth? Or is that not a feasible use case, and the space mining is only going to be useful for building stuff, you know, which is away from Earth?
Yeah, it's mostly the latter, I would say. When people have these sensational headlines around, oh, you have a 100 trillion worth of this asteroid, but you can't essentially bring it. Bringing it all the way to Earth is one dangerous.
Yeah.
If you miss up on the orbital dynamics a little bit, the asteroid could be heading towards Earth. You don't want that to be happening. And it's not easy to bring it. It's a huge, and it's not easy to sort of mine it and bring it back. Although that doesn't make sense. It's a very long-term, almost science fiction today, which will become science fact at some point in time, like most things have become, which is why it's a 50-year vision.
Mm-hmm.
If the resurgence of the space industry continues the way it is going right now, especially since the last decade, then inevitably you will get there. Or we might have a lull of 2 decades in there, but it will pick up again. So again, it's a question of when it will happen, not a question of...
Today there's no active space mining company.
There's no space mining company. There have been... 2 or 3 missions, for example, the Hayabusa 2 mission by Japanese Space Agency, where they went, touched the asteroid, got something and came back. There was the NASA Psyche mission that Lockheed Martin built. And there was one more mission before that, which sort of landed back on Earth with these things. So we are able to go and get a little bit of samples to see what these asteroids are actually made of. But we are still very far away from going and using different mining techniques to extract something. Like, it won't be normal mining either. Most of these are rubble. You might use innovative techniques like microwave mining. What that means is you essentially channel the sun's rays to vaporize certain chemicals or water and then use that as steam, store that, then water becomes your fuel. So we'll have to figure out such ways. So again, it's not anytime in the near future. It will take a generation or two more, hopefully, optimistically, to get there. But very early now. No one has really proved, except space agencies, that you can go extract something and come back.
So what are the things to look forward to over next 1 to 2 decades? You know, what's so there is... clearly, you know, resurgence in space.
Yeah.
I think there are way more private companies around the world. I think some of India is leading that. I think, I don't know count, but I mean, definitely India has its fair share of, you know, very interesting space companies. You know, you obviously being, you know, one of the key ones among them. What are the likely use cases which may happen next 10 to 20 years, which can really, you know, make space come of age and bring in serious industry and investment?
Yeah, I think one is already happening, which is reduction in launch cost. It has already reduced by, I think, 2 orders of magnitude over the last 2 decades. It will go even more with Starship coming up, an order of magnitude down. The biggest, over the next 10 years, the major focus will still be the lower Earth orbit economy. Not beyond that. Beyond that, we will continue to have space agencies funding a few companies to go set up bases on the moon and Mars. It won't be huge. It'll still be decent, I think, in a few billions or tens of billions. But most of the resurgence will happen in the low Earth orbit economy. The International Space Station is destined to come down by 2027, 2028, 2029, unless they extend it. But there are other companies planning on sending private space stations, which NASA will fund. These won't be just space stations where astronauts now go and do research. We are starting to see pharma companies seriously... do research in space to create certain protein structures that you can only create in microgravity. That gravity you can't create because of gravity. So there are certain protein structures for certain interventions in the pharmacy industry, medicine industry, that you can only do in space. Or things like creating a Zeeblan fiber optic cable, which is significantly more purer than normal fiber optic cables. The cost of doing that in space, bringing it down to Earth, might actually still make sense given the uniqueness and exoticness of this, and that cost is just going to keep coming down. So in the lower Earth economy, you obviously have imaging satellites that will continue to image in different kinds of imaging, telling us what is happening on the Earth. You'll have more and more communication satellites making sure that no matter where you're in the Earth, you always are connected to something. The days of not being connected in remote areas will be gone. But then the most interesting part of it will be, how will we start, you know, sending research to orbit? Space tourism will be one part of it. You know, the richest people in the world will start paying for actually going to the orbit, going to moon, having a flyby around the moon and so on, which is already happening with SpaceX. But the other things which are more interesting is, I think it will open up things for R&D in the science, actually understanding our universe a little bit better. When we launched JWST, James Webb Space Telescope, it was a month-long process to actually unfurl all of those sensors and detectors and send it where it needs to be. But when Starship, which is the single largest rocket built by significant margin, comes into the picture, we can launch even larger telescopes. More bases will be set up on the moon, and if you have a telescope on the other side of the moon, then you can use that to sort of look at more astrophysical phenomena that tell us a better understanding of where, you know, we came from, where the universe came from. So I would say it's a combination of commercial stuff, obviously, but also resurgence around the science and tech of understanding our universe a little bit better.
Amazing. I think it's a very, very exciting area to track. I think a lot of very interesting missions are planned, and you're right. I think the boost to research itself is going to probably a big, you know, and there's enough research funding available around the world.
Right.
Some of that get channeled into the companies which are building unique capabilities.
Yeah.
So you are, you know, pioneer in many ways, right? You know, pretty sure you're probably the first private, you know, satellite company out of India, and on definitely among the first, if not the first.
You know, it's India's first private commercial satellite.
Yes, yeah, so yeah, first private, you know, commercial satellite, which is, you know, breaking big, you know, ground. Where do you think the overall deep tech startup ecosystem in India is?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure a lot of people look up to you as inspiration, want to learn from your experience, you know, to the extent you track, you know, what are you observing, what's happening in space in particular and deep tech in general?
Yeah. I think overall, globally, deep tech and hard tech is seeing a resurgence. And I think that's where, personally, maybe a little bit biased, but the next couple of decades will be. The 1960s to the 1980s were the decade of building electronics and Moore's law and the semiconductor industry that made then the 90s, 2000s, 2010s and 20s the software decade. So it went from atoms, building in the atom space, to building in the bit space. I think now it's time to go back to the atoms while, you know, the bits take care of themselves. Where the resurgence is in terms of we finally have companies looking at building supersonic jets, Boom Aerospace in the US. You know, there was a Concorde at some point in time that went away, and now resurgence is happening. Lots of folks building either small nuclear reactors or fusion reactors. It might be a private company that does it before a government agency and government project actually ends up doing it, which would have been unfathomable a decade or two ago. Or even something as simple as robotics. Manufacturing, automating stuff, the medical space, the biotech space. I think what we saw in software in the 90s, 2000s, we will see in the biotech space as the genome has almost been decoded. As more and more tools like CRISPR and CRISPR-Cas and other things come into the picture, we will start tinkering with the genetic code of humans and other planets and see if we can, you know, eliminate certain types of diseases altogether. Nanotechnology, I think, at some point in time where we can assemble things molecule by molecule rather than sort of doing it the way that we do it now, which will open up a lot of things. Some of these might be 5-10 years away, like, you know, robotics, for example, with generational AI models coming into the picture. You have companies like Tesla's Optimus robot, or you have one more robot company that recently... Figure AI that raised money from ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Building these things where automation might become coming over to the picture. There's still automation and manufacturing remaining. And especially in India, I think industrialization is where we need to focus on till 2047.
Mm-hmm.
How China did it over the last three decades, Vietnam and Indonesia have been able to do it. We have that opportunity now to actually be the leader. And, you know, that can happen by one, increasing ways of power generation. Solar, wind, nuclear will be big. On top of that, building all of these industrial base for rockets and manufacturing and robots and satellites. And then, as I mentioned, I think biotech and gene tech and medicine becoming more precise and things like that. And of course, artificial intelligence will... We might have hit AGI. I mean, I think the goalposts keep changing. If 15 years ago, we would have said, if this is something that AI could do and ChatGPT could do, is this AGI? People would have said yes. Today, they say no. But we'll actually start to see actual AGI with, you know, Claude 3 Opus coming up and ChatGPT. So all of that just means that I think this is the day and age to, with the money available now, to for folks to actually build in the hardware space, while the software industry will continue to grow as well.
And what does it mean for, you know, people looking to start a deep tech company in India? See, deep tech is also in some ways, you know, pretty daunting. The time to market is much longer. Yeah. There's significant technology risk. Yeah. There's often regulatory risk, you know, which you guys had. You are able to overcome that.
Yeah.
What are your advice to someone, let's say, you know, people who are just coming out of college and have big dreams, want to do, you know, this incredible new cool tech?
Yeah.
How should one approach and also come to terms with the fact that, you know, there's potentially way more risky versus, I don't know, selling something online, you know, which is a lot easier to start?
Well, absolutely. I think the risk is much, much higher.
Yeah.
But the rewards are also higher. I would say anyone trying to getting into deep tech should know that it will be much longer than software company will take the time to see success. So anyone getting into deep tech or hard tech has to come mentally prepared that it will take years of slogging and grit and determination before you see some success. And then even then, you might do everything right and it might still not come to fruition, right? Which was personally my point of view that, look, I am 21 when I was starting it. Let's do it. let's see it for 5-10 years, and even if at the end of it doesn't work out, it's fine. I can go to something else. Age on my end, and I think being at Bits obviously gave me a little bit of coming from a privileged background to fall back on that ecosystem and that degree that came from there. Most people might not have that, right? So being just realistic, yes, it's cooler, and I think the time is right for it, but people have to be ready for the risk that it might not pan out. Or you could take the route that Elon Musk has taken or Sam Altman have taken, where build a software company, make money from that first, and then use that, and when you have a safety net, go and do, you know, hard tech.
But it's fair to say, like, if you look at your journey or Skyroot journeys, capital is not necessarily constrained. You can start with, you know, you said you start with $700,000 of funding,
yeah,
and you prove something, and, you know, just in less than 2 years, you managed to put a satellite in orbit. So I think that's at least one part. It's fair to say that, you know, capital is not going to be constrained.
It's not, I mean, it's still tough to raise money, right? Pixel has been almost dead at least twice or thrice.
That's every startup, the even the software and e-commerce companies also go through that near-death experience.
So absolutely, I think, as I said, if someone is passionate about this and willing to get through it, they absolutely should get into it. Today, I don't think there is a dearth of early stage capital that you would have been earlier.
Yeah.
One, there are more startup funding schemes from the Indian government itself, which at least makes sure there's non-dilutive capital.
Yeah.
A little bit, and it's growing. But there's also a lot of these pre-seed funds that have come out that are now focused on deep tech. Seed stage funds that have come out in deep tech. Overall, globally, people are also looking at putting money into India, which increase that pool of capital at the early stage, growth stage, early stages. So compared to 5 years ago, even today is much better in terms of the risk having come down.
Yeah.
Still risky. People have to be ready with it. But if you are passionate about it, and you just have to get started. Once you get started, the momentum will keep you going.
Amazing. Hopefully, I think that will inspire a lot of people. I think, Avesh, you know, I want to thank you for taking the time. I think Pixel's story is incredibly inspiring. I mean, it's very audacious to say at the age of 21 that we are going to build the most advanced satellite company anywhere in the world. It's also very unusual to have a 50-year vision when you're 21-year-old, and looks like, you know, you are committed to that vision, you know, really believe in it, and you've covered a lot of ground in just 5 years. 5 is a very short time frame for building a startup company, but I think you've a lot of risk is already off the table. I think I wish you all the best. I think the more, the better the, you know, Pixel does as a company, I think it will both inspire a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of deep tech entrepreneurs will come out of Pixel, and people will work with you for a few years. They'll learn the ropes and get inspired and build, you know, their own enterprising company. You know, might have happened already also.
Too kind, Mukesh. I think, you know, we looked up to people like you, having shown the path for entrepreneurs of our generation, and hopefully sometime in the future, I don't think we are there yet, that inspires other folks as well. But I think that's just the, you know, to pay it forward. But, you know, thanks for folks like you and others that paved the way for the startup ecosystem. And then hopefully, maybe in a few years when we do something more, we will do that for others also. Thank you.
No, thank you. We'll be watching out for this space, and we'll be rooting for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
At Sparks, we aim to bring to you stories of exponential impact. We share in-depth analysis of what goes behind success stories. If you find our conversations interesting, you can join us by subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can also listen to Sparks on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other audio platform of your choice. If you have any suggestions on who we should invite or what topics we need to cover, just let us know in the comments. We are always listening, looking for ways to improve, and keep getting better as we go along.